Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Shapiro, a U.S. International Solidarity Movement activist who describes the Israeli military assault on Ramallah and his experience being trapped in Yasser Arafat's besieged headquarters. Peter Hart of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who examines U.S. media coverage of the ongoing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And Ted Glick of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, who outlines plans for a large demonstration April 20th in Washington, D.C., denouncing the Bush administration's post-September 11th foreign and domestic policies. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For 30 years, prison inmates were used in experimental drug tests with little concern for their welfare. The news magazine In These Times reports that until the early 1970s, American doctors injected and infected inmates with malaria, typhoid fever, hepatitis, and syphilis in repeated experiments to find cures for these diseases. In October 2000, 300 former prisoners filed a lawsuit seeking damages against a University of Pennsylvania dermatologist, Dow Chemical, and Johnson & Johnson. The plaintiffs were all inmates at Philadelphia's Holmesburg Prison and claimed that medical researchers exposed them to dangerous and toxic agents. Due to the exposure of abuses in using prisoners during test trials for drugs, reforms were made during the 1980s and testing of prisoners was halted. But in recent years, interest has exploded in using prisoners as test subjects again, especially in treatment of HIV and AIDS. But critics and prisoners' rights activists warn that there are not enough safeguards in place to prevent possible abuses. The ACLU's Jackie Warner explained, "We don't want prisoners to be used as guinea pigs for trials that companies could not complete in the community." Blackfeet tribal member Josephine Wildgun has made the case that she was swindled by the U.S. government. She lives in a rundown house on an Indian reservation in Montana. Yet, like other Blackfeet, Wildgun owns land held in trust by the U.S. government and leased away to timber and cattle interests. However, Wildgun and other tribal members never saw much of a payoff. Her largest royalty checks were $1,500 a year, an amount that has decreased over time. Currently, over 300,000 Native Americans are suing the U.S. Interior Department, who managed the Indian Trust Fund, for over $10 billion in back payments and return of control over 10 million acres of land. In 1999, U.S. District Judge Royce Lambert ruled that then-Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt was in contempt of court for failing to produce documents and issued a $625,000 fine. Last December, the same judge issued another sanction against current Interior Secretary Gail Norton for providing false and misleading information. According to Mother Jones magazine, the trust fund has been a mess since it was created in 1887. The fund was an easy way to get access to reservation land and hand out leases to private interests. For years, the Bureau of Indian Affairs failed to collect lease payments, and upwards of 90% of the trust records are now missing. In late February, North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan made a plea on the floor of the U.S. Senate for renewal of the Wind Production Tax Credit, designed to jumpstart the emerging renewable energy industry. Clean energy advocates hope to tack an extension of the tax credit onto the bill to extend unemployment benefits. Instead, the powers that be on Capitol Hill held the tax credit and inserted it into the Senate energy bill, already filled with massive subsidies for coal, oil, and nuclear industry interests. In the process, the wind tax credit only became green window dressing for hiding $36 billion to aid the promoters of fossil fuels and nuclear power. Despite the Washington power plays, renewable clean energy has a bright future. Costs are dropping for wind and solar energy, and it is now competitive with new coal and natural gas plants. According to The Nation magazine, renewable energy has hit prime time in Europe and Japan. Ireland, for example, has just announced that it will build a wind energy park that could generate two-thirds of Europe's energy needs by 2020. Yet, Senate Democrats fail to act to boost the potential for renewable energy and continue to play footsie with oil, coal, and nuclear interests. This is despite the fact that energy companies give 90% of their political contributions to Republicans. Congress recently ignored House Democrat leader Dick Gephardt's proposal to fund a plan to build 100,000 cars powered by hydrogen fuel cells. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Cousineau.
Adam Shapiro, a 30-year-old American activist, found himself in the media spotlight after he accompanied an ambulance to Yasser Arafat's besieged Ramallah headquarters on Easter weekend, soon after Israel launched a large-scale military attack against West Bank cities. Shapiro, who has lived in the occupied territories for 2.5 years, is among hundreds of nonviolent International Solidarity Movement volunteers who have put their lives on the line to offer protection and humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians caught in the crossfire there. The young man from Brooklyn, New York, was forced to stay overnight in Arafat's compound after he convinced Israeli officers to permit an ambulance safe passage to evacuate the wounded from the Palestinian leader's headquarters. The next morning, he had breakfast with Arafat, and eventually Israeli forces, which had surrounded the area with tanks and troops, allowed him to leave. Shapiro's experience was widely reported in the U.S. and international press, provoking death threats against his parents living in New York from those who charged Shapiro with being a traitor and supporting terrorism. Between the Lines, Scott Harris reached Shapiro in Ramallah by cell phone and asked him about the work of the International Solidarity Movement and what he has witnessed during the current Israeli military assault on West Bank cities.
The International Solidarity Movement is a network of international and Palestinian activists and grassroots community organizations, usually working using nonviolence to conduct actions against the occupation and help work with Palestinians to struggle for freedom. This has included removal of roadblocks, replanting uprooted trees, rebuilding homes, and protesting. Currently, because of the ongoing military assault on Palestinian towns throughout the West Bank, the internationals who are here have been forced into serving much more in a humanitarian capacity, delivering food, delivering medicine, volunteering on ambulances to help bring wounded and dead to the hospital. This is primarily because Palestinian Red Crescent ambulances and Red Cross workers have been detained and arrested when they have been out trying to bring the wounded to hospital. Ambulances have been shot at and have been confiscated by the Israeli forces. So we have found that putting an international on board to volunteer has actually helped sort of create a safety net to allow the medics and the doctors to work.
Tell our listeners a little bit about how you came to be in Yasser Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah during a time of the Israeli siege. I believe you were there ostensibly to bring a medical evacuation of some of the wounded.
Right. I was actually volunteering on an ambulance during the first 24-hour period of the Israeli invasion of Ramallah. I had been helping to bring wounded and dead to the hospital throughout the day, and we had received information that there were two critically wounded people at the compound who needed to be removed to hospital, or else certainly at least one of them would surely have died, given that he had been losing blood for many hours. I went to the compound with an ambulance. On board was a Palestinian doctor, a medic, and another international colleague of mine. I spent about 3 hours negotiating with the soldiers to get access to the compound, after which time they finally allowed us in. Once inside, we started to treat the wounded, put the two critically injured on board the ambulance. I stayed behind to help the doctor inside treat more of the wounded and to get an assessment of the situation. We sent out the ambulance with two of the critically wounded, another Palestinian doctor, my Irish colleague, and I was expecting the ambulance to come back to pick me up later on. However, as the ambulance got to the exit of the compound, it was stopped. It was searched for about an hour, at the end of which time everybody on board was arrested, including the critically injured. The only one who was released was my Irish colleague, and she joined me back in the compound, at which point we were both stuck, as the ambulance was confiscated.
Having been stuck in Yasser Arafat's headquarters, you got to spend some time with the Palestinian leader. What were your impressions, and what kind of discussions went on there?
I was invited to come up and explain why, you know, what we were doing in the compound and what the other internationals were doing inside Ramallah to help the Palestinian people and to help, you know, in this humanitarian crisis. President Arafat offered his thanks for our role and for our courage in coming to the compound as it was under siege. In fact, while we were inside, there was continuous tank shelling of the compound and heavy machine gun fire against the building in which we were in.
Could you describe briefly some of the destruction you've witnessed since the Israeli incursions into several West Bank cities?
The downtown area, the main street is completely demolished. Shopping centers are, you know, burned out. All the store windows are broken glass, twisted metal. The front facade of one building was blown off into the street. This is just in Ramallah. And from what we're hearing, especially in the Nablus, in the Kasbah, the old city, that parts of that old city, which is quite old and quite historic, have been utterly destroyed. From the Jenin area, including the refugee camp, we're getting word of homes being demolished with the people still inside and now buried under the rubble. So it's really quite awful.
I've read stories locally here in the United States that your parents are under death threat because some people think you're a traitor to the Jewish religion for what they see as some kind of alliance that you've made with Yasser Arafat and what they claim to be terrorism.
There is no such alliance. There is no such endorsement of President Arafat or of terror or of any kind of violence. We work using nonviolent techniques and activities to try and allow the Palestinians to struggle for freedom and to end the occupation. It's true that my family has been receiving death threats, and I think that's largely as a result of ignorance and hatred and a very dangerous form of sectarianism and ethnicism that I think is part of one reason, or at least part of the reason of this conflict and why it's so hard to find a solution.
That was International Solidarity Movement activist Adam Shapiro speaking from the Palestinian city of Ramallah. Visit the movement's website at www.palsolidarity.org. The Israeli army's recent attack against major West Bank cities and refugee camps has been repeatedly justified by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon as a necessary step to uproot the infrastructure of terrorism and to prevent further Palestinian suicide bomb attacks against civilians in Israel. President Bush, alarmed at growing unrest in the Arab world, demanded that Israel immediately withdraw from Palestinian territory, a call Sharon has resisted by continuing military operations. Despite Israel's often violent effort to ban the International Press Corps from covering the hostilities, reports of summary executions, the bulldozing of homes on top of their inhabitants, and the denial of medical care, food, and water to civilians as ordered by the Israeli army have circulated around the world. Groups like the International Red Cross and Amnesty International have increasingly made public statements condemning Israel's conduct in the current clash. But with few exceptions, U.S. media outlets and especially television commentators provide viewers with a decidedly pro-Israeli view of the conflict. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Hart of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, who examines the corporate media's coverage of the violent struggle between Israelis and Palestinians and the symbolic use of language in network newscasts.
The attacks on journalists themselves have sort of thrust reporters into this role where they're part of this story of a very violent and sometimes disorganized, aggressive campaign, particularly in the West Bank. We've had journalists who were fired upon, who were harassed. Some have been detained, and their papers have been inspected. And some have even been killed. So we have a media who are feeling, in one sense, in one very small sense, the brunt of this occupying force themselves, and it's hard not to notice that in some of the coverage, in particular the TV coverage, where journalists are working under circumstances that make it literally impossible to get at the areas where the story is happening. So on the one hand, that's what's new. We have journalists that can't even get to some of the areas that they're reporting on. What little we know, and you read off some of the headlines, what little we know is based largely on very crafty journalists who are getting behind the military lines and reporting back what they're seeing. My fear is that we only know a small part of it. Some of the larger questions, though, about coverage of Israel and Palestine are still true. And these are problems that have been true for years and continue to be true. We hear about violence and we hear about retaliation, but we don't understand what Americans cannot understand if they rely on much of the mainstream media, is the sense of desperation, of hopelessness, and of a lack of a political solution for the problem being an Israeli military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So we understand the day-to-day violence, but what we don't understand are the reasons behind it and the political realities that sort of motivate some of the violence. So part of that has to do with the fact that the opinion makers and the TV pundits are so overwhelmingly one-sided on an issue like this. We don't even see advocates for Palestinian human rights and for a Palestinian state. We don't see those forceful advocates in the media unless they are spokespeople for the Palestinian cause.
Right.
Regular sort of American media pundits just do not take up that as their issue. So it is a situation where you can't even name the prominent television or newspaper pundits that are advocates for the Palestinian cause. And this doesn't mean that people have to ignore acts of terror on either side or have to be particularly fans of Yasser Arafat. But if you want to read opinions that support the rights and the sort of dreams of a Palestinian state, then you have to oftentimes go overseas.
You have the Palestinians and Israelis often claiming that their attacks are retaliation for previous strikes by the other side. And you at FAIR did some investigating about the numbers of times and the apportionment of that terminology, retaliation, how it was used and how it affected the viewers.
What we wanted to do was see how often the media, in particular the nightly newscasts, use that term retaliation and how they use it. The reason we chose this term was because it's a very important concept for people. I think it does impact the way people see the conflict, because if you understand that a group is retaliating, then you do get the impression very directly, I think, that the opposing force is the one that sort of started this cycle of violence. And what we found about 150 times that the term was used to describe attacks in this conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And about 79% of the references were to Israeli retaliation against Palestinians. About 9% referred to Palestinian retaliation. So if you've been watching the nightly news since September of 2000, over and over again, you've heard this term, but you've heard it applied overwhelmingly to one side in the conflict, which does give viewers the impression that, in fact, one side has been put upon by the other side and is always in sort of a defensive posture. And what we wanted to do was to demonstrate that since both sides use retaliation as an explanation for what they're doing, it's the job of journalists to decide whether or not to report that. You don't need to endorse the claim by a Hamas suicide bomber that he or she is retaliating for any given attack, but it's very important to report it. Otherwise, violence in the Middle East just comes out of thin air. So that's essentially what we were looking at, and hopefully trying to advance some understanding that this is a very loaded term that journalists should approach with extreme caution. Either use it fairly or not use it at all.
That was Peter Hart of the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Contact FAIR by calling area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. In the aftermath of the September 11th terror attacks, President Bush and his policies are widely supported by a great majority of Americans, according to public opinion polls. The war in Afghanistan, which was launched in October to destroy Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, the group believed to have masterminded the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, is viewed by many around the country as a resounding success. The country is assured that the terrorist threat is being neutralized, even though bin Laden and many of his associates are still at large. The White House has since deployed U.S. troops to several nations, including the Philippines, Yemen, and the Republic of Georgia. And the Bush administration has openly pointed to Iraq as being the next target in the war against terrorism. But not everyone in America is happy with the Bush policies. Citizens have raised questions about the 4,000 civilians estimated to have been killed by U.S. bombs in Afghanistan, the concern that violence alone will not stop future terrorist attacks, the secret detention of thousands of immigrants, and the defunding of critical social programs here in the U.S. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ted Glick of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, who serves on the steering committee of a coalition of groups organizing a major demonstration April 20th in Washington, D.C., dubbed the March to Stop the War at Home and Abroad. Glick outlines the reasons why thousands of citizens will be coming to the nation's capital to condemn the Bush administration's foreign and domestic policies.
Our overarching theme is Stop the War at Home and Abroad. We are very upset, very concerned, even scared about what has happened since September 11th, how the Bush administration has used that terrible act, those terrible attacks, in a way that is furthering their agenda. Imperial expansion of getting even more control of oil, of inserting U.S. military bases into the Middle East, of taking money away from education and health care and cleaning up the environment, totally sidetracking, derailing the issue of dealing with global warming and instead militarizing the world, dominating and controlling the media so that alternative voices very rarely get put out. And now with this situation in the Middle East, it's like a tinderbox, and people are talking that we literally are in danger of World War III. That's not an exaggeration with the way things are unfolding because of what the Bush administration is doing. It's a very urgent situation. And so we have come together, the April 20th mobilization. We are working with several other national mobilization efforts, the Columbia mobilization, the Mobilization for Global Justice and International Answer, to pull off a powerful, big, there will definitely be tens of thousands of people in Washington, D.C. There's no question of that. The only question is how many tens of thousands. We think that it is absolutely essential to get the largest number and the broadest turnout that we can for this day. This can be an historic day, and we hope our listeners will respond accordingly.
The polls suggest that President Bush is very popular at this moment after the September 11th attacks, and that his program, his military response, is also quite popular. Do you think there are just pockets, small numbers of people out there that are questioning the Bush policies, or is there quite a bit more folks out there that have trouble with the direction of the government than the major media indicates?
I don't think there's any question, but that lots of people are concerned about what's happening. I think one of the problems is that some of those people, many of those people who are concerned, don't have access to alternative media.
so that they don't really hear on any consistent basis the alternative voices. And as a result, they get sucked in. But there's also activism, and there has been activism. And we know that there are people coming in buses from just about all over the country. There will be hundreds and hundreds of buses that are going to be bringing people to D.C. I think what's happening is that pockets of opposition to this war drive that has been continuing and developing and building, those pockets have been expanding, have been getting larger, and we expect that we will see that we really have a movement now, a new peace and justice movement. It's not been very visible by and large, but it's going to come out on April 20th.
Ted Glick, members of the Bush administration, most prominently Attorney General John Ashcroft, have, in quite blunt terms, questioned individuals' patriotism who are in any way questioning the Bush administration policies on fighting terrorism. How do you respond to those critics of peace movements and other groups that are in opposition to the Bush policies?
Well, we're the ones fighting for this country. We're the ones fighting for the people of this country. We're fighting for the environment of the whole world. We are fighting for the best principles that this country is supposed to be about. We're in the tradition of the abolitionists and the women's movement and the civil rights movement and the labor movement and past peace movements. We are standing squarely in that tradition. And for Ashcroft to say his ridiculous statement that we are not patriotic is ridiculous. We think that it's essential that people speak up and that they act to counter that kind of McCarthyism, this 21st century McCarthyism. The Patriot Act, with its various measures of repression, the dramatic expansion of the power of the government, the FBI, the intelligence agencies, to secretly eavesdrop, to snoop, to break into people's homes, all without court orders. The immigrants, particularly from the Middle East, who are disappeared into prison, many of them not able to have family members visit. Family don't even know where they are. You know, it happens to them, and it will happen to others if we don't stand up also for them. So we think that we are very firmly in the best traditions of this country.
That was Ted Glick of the Independent Progressive Politics Network and the April 20th Mobilization Committee. To contact the office coordinating the April 20th protest, call area code 202-265-3980 or visit their website at www.unitedwemarch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.